you from Gunai Kurnai Lands, we wish to pay our respect to Elders past, present, future and emerging. This is the Theories of Hope podcast. Please be advised that some subject matters may be upsetting for some listeners and discretion is advised. Nor is this podcast a substitute for professional advice and is intended as general information only. Welcome to Theories of Hope. I'm your host, Beck Howlett, and I have with me today Linda Rowley. Linda is a wellbeing specialist with an interest in grief and loss. Linda has completed a master's in applied positive psychology, coupled with various courses in death and dying. With a special interest in ambiguous loss, Linda draws on research from the fields of ambiguous loss, positive psychology, and wellbeing science, coupled with her own lived experience. Linda is also the host of the Haptivist podcast, which aims to inspire action for compassionate and connected society. Thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me on, Beck. It's lovely to be here.
Oh, thank you. And before we get started, can you just tell me briefly, what is it about positive psychology that interested you in studying this and working with people who experience grief and loss?
Yeah, so great question, thank you. I first became interested in positive psychology not long after I was recovering from breast cancer. So I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer when I was 39. My mum and I were diagnosed 3 months apart. So my mum had been diagnosed 3 months before me, and mine was more progressed. So it was a long journey of both surgeries and treatment. And recovering from that, really sparked my interest, I think, in positive psychology. When I saw the oncologist, I said to him, you know, obviously you see people who survive the type of cancer that I have and those that don't. So, you know, what do you see as the difference? And his response seemed really simplistic to me. He said, luck and attitude. Oh, let me say that again. So his response was both luck and attitude. And at that stage in my life, I decided I wasn't going to leave anything to luck. So mm-hmm. I decided the attitude had it. So that's when I started studying positive psychology. And lots of people, I think there's a misconception sometimes about what positive psychology is. It doesn't mean being positive all the time. It doesn't mean, mm-hmm. you know, toxic positivity. It is about embracing, you know, all of the emotions and mm-hmm. looking at what it is that helps us to live a good life, a life of, you know, joy and a life of meaning and purpose and contribution. So that really spoke to me at that time in my life. And in terms of the second part of your question mm-hmm. around grief, when I actually studied my Master's of Applied Positive Psychology, my capstone research project was on end of life. So mm-hmm. for me, I wanted to try and understand what wellbeing science or positive psychology could offer in terms of helping people to have a better end-of-life experience mm-hmm. and also helping those who are bereaved mm-hmm. to perhaps cope with what was happening for them and their grief. So it has been a combination of very much personal experience. I think mm-hmm. the end-of-life, my interest in that was really prompted by my mum, who died of breast cancer within 5 years of our diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I also have, you know, significant experience with ambiguous loss, both in terms mm-hmm. of my own health conditions as mm-hmm. well as, you know, being a carer for family members and other life events as well. So very much my work blends both the professional kind of academic side of things and also the experiences that I've had.
Well said. I think it's beautifully said, and I personally can relate to a lot of that. It's part of why I started this podcast around theories of hope. It was a research article that I saw around hope theory, which is based a little bit in positive psychology, and that we see significant improvements in health outcomes and long-term health outcomes and sociological outcomes for people who have hope. So certainly I have significant experience myself, so it's going to be wonderful to speak to you. Can we talk a bit about what is grief and what does it look like?
Yeah, so grief is one of those terms that's a bit of a slippery fish, really, in that I think there are so many definitions of grief and as many individual experiences of grief as there are, you know, humans walking around, really. So the definition that resonates with me the most is that grief is a natural response to loss. And mm-hmm. I really like that because it's broad. It talks about, you know, the emotional suffering that you feel during times of grief. And sometimes it's described as, you know, anguish. But it not only affects our emotions, it can also affect our thoughts and feelings, sometimes even our belief systems. You know, I know people who turn to spirituality in ways that they haven't done previously after, you know, experiencing perhaps the death of a loved one or a significant loss. It can also impact our relationships with others. And of course, it's different for everyone. There's no cookie cutter, you know, mm-hmm. kind of grief experience.
Mm. And I think that that's the important point for listeners to hear, is that it does look different for absolutely everyone. It's how you individually respond to loss, and not necessarily the loss of someone's passing, but loss in what you perceive as loss in your significant loss in your life.
Sorry, yeah, absolutely. Oh, no, that's okay. I think, you know, what you've touched on there is leading into our ambiguous loss as well, which we might get to talk about in a little bit.
That was my next question.
Okay. So in terms of ambiguous loss, ambiguous loss is a term that was coined in the late 1970s by Dr. Pauline Boss when she was doing her doctoral research. And yet it's not a term that is a common or kind of, you know, household known mm-hmm. term, really. Yet when I start talking about ambiguous loss, I find that most people can relate to it and mm-hmm. most people tend to have an experience of it. So I'm not sure if I've cut you off now. Are you happy for me to keep going or did you want to ask me?
No, keep talking. That was exactly my next question. What is ambiguous loss?
Yeah. So Pauline Boss has continued to research it the last four decades or so now. And she's identified two types of ambiguous loss. So type one ambiguous loss is when a person is no longer physically present in your life, mm-hmm. but you still have a psychological relationship with them. So everyday examples of that would be things like relationship breakdown. So, you know, divorce, separation. The two people are no longer together, but for one person, they still hold the other person in their heart and mind. Mm-hmm. It could also be things like people who migrate or mm-hmm. Adoption would be mm-hmm. another example of that. Or more catastrophic examples are people who are missing in action, for instance, or that sort of thing. So it's really when we still have that psychological relationship, we still feel connected generally to a person. It could also be a pet or a furry family member, but they're no longer physically with us. And the second type of ambiguous loss is the reverse of that. So when the person is still physically present, but when they're no longer psychologically present. So there's been a change in the relationship in some way, and that could be due to things like dementia, or it could be a serious health condition. It could be an acquired brain injury, whether that's through stroke or a traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who experiences a severe mental illness, for instance, mm-hmm. or addiction, whether that's to substances or their phone. but the psychological relationship that we have has changed in some way. The person is no longer there for us in ways that they've previously been.
Mm. Yes. And can you explain a little bit about what the cycles of grief are? Because I know that most of us have a kind of vague idea of what the cycles of grief are if someone passes away. And it's also important to note that it's not laid in stone. You don't necessarily progress from 1, 2, 3, 4. We tend to go 1, 5, 2, 7. You know, not everybody's the same. It looks different for everybody. But that's especially true around an ambiguous loss, that it can display quite differently. And I've certainly experienced this, and I know friends who have experienced it, where they can get very frustrated with themselves because they feel like they're just grieving too long. Like, why can't I just get over this? So can we talk about that for a second, about, you know, what are the cycles of grief and how they present?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think this goes back to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work on death and dying, and this goes back to the late 1960s. So 1969, she introduced her five stages of grief model, and there's been conjecture since then that this was never supposed to be a prescriptive, you know, stage or model of grief. And people are probably familiar with those stages. They're denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And as you said, Beck, they're not a linear process, right? So we can go backwards and forwards between them. And you know, and I think that can be a really helpful model for some people, if you kind of identify yourself within those particular stages. I think the caution around specific models for me is that then if our grief looks something different to those five stages, then there's perhaps a tendency to wonder if I'm doing grief right, right? Mm-hmm. Like so I think sometimes there's a bit of a danger in that it doesn't perhaps really facilitate that sense of, you know, grief is unique and individual and may not look like any of those stages for some people, you know. When it comes to ambiguous loss, that's different again. Ambiguous loss has some characteristics that grief doesn't particular, that the grief related to a death doesn't particularly have. So, for instance, the key thing with ambiguous loss is that there's a lack of clarity around what that loss actually might be and what might happen in the future. So if you think about, for instance, if I'm in a relationship with someone who develops dementia, there's the uncertainty around, you know, what will that dementia actually look like? There will be moments for that person where they are lucid, right? And we can have a great conversation and feel that sense of connection, and then there will be other times where that's just not the case, mm-hmm. and that's unpredictable. So there's no kind of sense of resolution around that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes the same with, you know, with relationship breakdown as well. You can see that there's uncertainty around what that relationship might evolve to and the elements. So the big part of ambiguous loss is really the uncertainty, Equally, we don't have any rituals around ambiguous loss either. So when someone dies and we grieve for them, there's generally rituals, whether that's a funeral or a memorial service or sitting shiva or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it happens to be. within kind of the cultural practices or the religious or spiritual beliefs. But when it comes to ambiguous loss, there's no rites or rituals around that. And so there's no sense of coming together as community and being supported around that either. And so ambiguous loss can often be disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. So we're not sure we have the right to grieve, right? Or maybe at times we can't even articulate what it is we're grieving about, you know, like what that sense of loss is. And so there's a lack of social validation. We don't have anyone saying to us, oh gosh, you know, I'm really sorry. Sorry for this loss. I can see how hard it is for you. Mm-hmm. So, and I think about, you know, roles as carers, for instance, often, and again, depending on the situation, because every situation is different, often though, carers don't just suddenly become a carer overnight. There will be some instances where they do, but often it's a slow kind of, you know, process to having someone who becomes unwell and then, you know, gradually identifying as a carer yourself. Mm-hmm. So there's no kind of neat point at which, you know, you can go, I'm now a carer. This is a sense of loss for me. So I think all of those things complicate that sense of ambiguous loss. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, if we talk about stages of grief, which was, I'm coming around to your question, it's just mm-hmm. taking me a while. If we talk about stages of grief, that's not as applicable, I don't think, to mm-hmm. ambiguous loss. And what Pauline Boss talks about in the literature in her work is that she talks about oscillations and mm-hmm. she says, you know, there will be times when the grief is really intense and overwhelming and it oscillates, you know. There will be other times when it's kind of more to the background, when, you know, as people who experience ambiguous loss, we might go through, you know, significant and extended periods of well-being, right, where we have this sense of, you know, joy and completeness and meaning or whatever well-being means for us. And there will be other times when we just really feel the weight of that mm-hmm. ambiguous loss. So, and, you know, things like significant dates, whether that's, you know, birthdays or Christmas or, you know, Mother's Day or anniversaries, those sorts of things where we might feel that sense of loss more acutely. And then other times when we can live a good life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you've put that absolutely perfectly, which kind of leads into one of my other questions that I wanted to talk about, which is the process of almost lifelong grief. And I think that because we live in a society that tends to understand grief when it relates to someone's death, you know, whenever there's a birthday come around or a Christmas or a special occasion, we understand that that's going to be triggering and that's going to be hard. But when it's ambiguous loss, there's this really almost incorrect social expectation that, you know, oh for goodness sakes, you've been divorced for years, why are you suddenly having an episode now and being upset? You know, I'll use myself as an example for listeners. You know, I nursed my mum who was terminally ill for many years. Absolutely, I grieved the loss of her. I nursed her from when I was 10 to 24. So I was 10 years old and they said she's going to survive 2 weeks. Within 2 weeks, I went from healthy to having severe psoriasis on 80% of my body. I looked like I had leprosy because my skin was falling off in chunks. I had long blonde hair and 3/4 of it was covered in pus and blood and chunks of flesh. And that stayed for years until the doctors said, actually, medications and science have advanced enough. We can probably keep your mum alive. But the amount of times that she would have seizures and convulsions and, you know, she was over 300 pounds. And I'd have to grab her and pick her and throw her to the ground and put her in a position and shove medication down her throat and keep her breathing because in those convulsions, her body would forget how to breathe. And so she'd pass away. And then at the point past passing away, the body's natural survival instinct would kick in, and all of a sudden she'd gasp for air. And I'm 10 years old and I'm constantly observing that. And then in the middle of all that is the fact that my mum was a wonderful woman, but she really had the emotional developmental capacity of a fluctuating 8 to 13-year-old. She wasn't really emotionally – she loved us kids, but she did not have the functional capacity to have children. She suffered a severe trauma herself at a young age, at 8, and I think it kind of just sort of trapped her there. And she had extreme emotional swings, and so with that would come some domestic violence. You know, she taught me to make a cup of tea by every time I made it and she didn't like it, she'd throw it on me until I eventually got it right. I say all that because by the time my mum passed away, I was 30. I stopped looking after my mum when I was 24 because I had a mild nervous breakdown and the doctors were like, enough, you can't have another one. So my older sister took over care. But I did that exclusively on my own because when I was 10, my siblings are in their 20s. They're in their 20s. They're just like, oh, for God's sakes, we don't want to look after mum. It can't possibly be that bad. And it was very hard for them to wrap their head around the idea that mum was really as sick as she was. Anyway, by the time mum passed away, I was relieved that she was finally gone because for whatever traumas I had gone through, make no mistake, that woman lived a horrific life. Her illnesses were absolutely violent. They were awful. For me, I felt no point in seeking justice because, my God, she suffered in this life. Like, she excruciatingly suffered. So by the time she passed away, I was like, oh, thank God. But that doesn't mean that throughout my life I didn't experience extreme grief for a whole host of different things, including loss of childhood, loss of safety, loss of independence. You know, I was abused as a child and mum didn't protect me. In fact, she defended, you know, there's all sorts of things. And yes, they come with their own diagnosis. As listeners will know, I'm diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder. But you still also grieve the loss of that.
Oh, so, absolutely.
Yeah. And so as an adult, when she passed away, I didn't grieve the loss of her death. But it did trigger just the loss of my childhood again and that. And so what I find as an adult, and I'm thriving by every stretch of the imagination, I'm very grateful to say I am thriving. I know that from a clinical diagnosis point of view, I am thriving. But there are still times where individually certain things will happen and I've got to sit with myself for a day or two because that loss, that grief, is re-triggered. And it's profound. In those moments, it's profound. I will absolutely howl with anguish and be crying for the loss. The adult parent, or a parent myself, will howl for, oh my God, my heart is breaking for 10-year-old me. You know, and then there's just the loss of, oh my God, why couldn't my mum love me the way she was supposed to? Yada, yada, yada. There's so much complexity for it. And I've had people, well-meaning people, go, shouldn't you be over this now? And it's like, that's not how it works. It's especially not how it works with CPS, PTSD, but that's not how grief works. And similarly, I have friends who have endured male and female because domestic violence does not, you know, it's not just men who perpetrate it. It's absolutely women as well. Who, you know, 15 years later, after they've been divorced from their spouse, will still have a moment or something, especially if there's kids involved, and there'll be grief. And they'll be like, oh, my God, why is this still an issue for me? Why is the fact that my current spouse just showed me some kindness suddenly triggering me? And it's grief because they lost something significant. They were in a relationship with their former spouse for a long time and it was violent, or it was a short time but it was extremely violent, or whatever the situation being. And yet society poses these unrealistic expectations where if it's ambiguous loss, you're supposed to just suck it up, you know, and get on with it, and it's supposed to have a finite end date. That's functionally not realistic.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And it's really interesting because Pauline Boss would say that, you know, we can't, you're not going to fix ambiguous loss. We can't cure ambiguous loss. So it's really about how do we learn to live well with ambiguous loss. And you've raised some really interesting points. Firstly, though, I'd like to say that I'm truly sorry to hear that that happened to you. So I'd like to acknowledge that. And I'd also, I think when it comes to ambiguous loss, one of the things is that the losses we experience can be both tangible as well as intangible. So tangible losses can be things like, you know, the loss of finances if we need to give up our job or we need to stop going to school to care for someone, that sort of thing. The intangible losses are those things that, you know, it's the loss of our hopes and dreams or the loss of a childhood as we thought it might be. And they are every bit as real and every bit as significant. So I think that's the first thing to underscore. And the second thing is that, and again, you really have described this really well, is that when we're in a caring role or we feel a sense of ambiguous loss and the person dies, our grief around the death can often be quite different because sometimes we have, you know, gone through that ambiguous, that grieving period around ambiguous loss for quite some time. So then when death occurs for the person, we don't necessarily experience grief in the same way. And for people looking on the outside looking in, sometimes there can be some sense of judgment around that, perhaps, you know, if people don't have a good understanding or a good kind of grief literacy around what might be happening for the person. So I think, you know, there are certain things that we can do that are indicated in the literature. So whilst we can't fix it or cure it, there are, you know, specific strategies or things we can do that can make living with ambiguous loss, you know, can make life a little better when we are living with ambiguous loss.
Speaking of different grief scenarios where you grieve differently, there are different situations where the death of someone will also prompt a different grief response. One of the situations that I'm thinking of is suicide or suicidality, which is incredibly painful for people, both if you're the person that you're worried about is still living and you know that that friend or family member is suffering with suicidality, and you're constantly worrying about what's going to happen. Are they going to take their life? Have I done something wrong? Is there more that I can do? And then if they do take their lives, speaking about that, I can speak from personal experience for the sake of our listeners. You know, suicidality is it's a beast in its own making, and I want to make our listeners aware that it's not anything that you can fix or cure overnight, and it's not something that you did wrong or anything like that. I know for myself, so mine was prompted as a result of grief. So for many years, I did live with suicidal thoughts. And I found it incredibly hard, and it was like white knuckling it through. And that was born out of I don't know if this is the correct terminology. I really don't. I can only speak from my experience of it. It felt to me like a personal, desperate kind of grief, a grief that I was feeling in relation to a loss of my childhood. I will say this, it was born out of a genuine and sincere belief that the world and everybody that I cared about was better off without me. And nobody could have convinced me otherwise. Even though in my head I intellectually understood that that was most likely nonsense, and even though I had therapists and I was discussing it with my psychiatrist, trying to emotionally understand that that wasn't true is a whole other beast. And emotionally, yeah, that hole, that gaping hole that leaves you feeling like, the only way I can describe it is when I grew up, I was regularly told that, and this is part of the grief that I had for my childhood, was that you haven't got a father who loves you, so how can you expect God to love you? And I was regularly led to believe that Satan himself had more redeemable qualities than me. So from a very young age and for a very long time, I used to beg and plead with God himself just to let me die, basically. Just let me die. I didn't want to be alive. Because I truly believed there was nothing redeemable about me and that I was an abomination and that God himself despised me and hated me and wished I wasn't alive. Now, I can't say that every person who suffers with suicidality believes to that extent, but one thing that we all have in common is a powerlessness and a hopelessness, and that feeling of the world and everybody that we care about just fundamentally being better off without me and without us. And there's nothing that anybody can say or do when someone's got that thought or that belief ruminating in their head. You can't, no matter how much you want to, you can't love somebody out of that. I was incredibly fortunate. In the end, all the therapy in the world, and I was thriving, and then I'd regularly become sort of suicidal again. And we eventually figured out that in my case, my hormones also played a huge part. And then we figured it out, and then I was placed on an Implanon hormone replacement as well as a Mirena hormone replacement. The moment I had both, my suicidality disappeared within 24 hours. And I haven't suffered with suicidality for a number of years. I still take antidepressants. I'm personally on 200 milligrams of Prestique, which is a moderate dose. And I take a little bit of mirtazapine, that's me. And I still reach out to therapy if I need it. But thankfully, I no longer suffer with suicidality. I still have depressive episodes because I still have complex post-traumatic stress disorder, but they're not suicidal. They're not. The point that I am probably badly making and that I just want my listeners to understand, because there's these tropes out in society that, oh, suicide is the most selfish thing you can possibly do. And let me tell you, as someone who suffered with suicidality, it's the furthest thing from selfishness for the vast majority of us. That's not what's going through their head, and it's not something that you can fix. So I do desperately want my listeners to understand you are not at fault. If you suffer from it, you are not at fault. It's just a beast of a thing that is beyond your control. If it's a family member that's going through it, it's not your fault. All you can do is love them and support them as best you can. Have those conversations with their therapists and doctors around what can I do to support them. Mostly just monitor them and get them, you know, into therapy and when they need it. But make no mistake, this is not something that you can rescue someone from. It is unfortunately a bit of trial and error around who recovers from it and who doesn't. That being said, how do we handle that kind of grief as it's happening? Mm-hmm. And especially, how do we have those age-appropriate conversations as well when something like that's happened, or indeed any situation, maybe it's someone with a terminal illness. How do we have those really big conversations like that? How do we manage that grief, and how do we have those conversations with our loved ones?
I think you've raised such important points there. And, you know, in terms of people's experience of grief, there are many factors that can influence that. You know, the age of the person that's grieving, whether it's a younger person or perhaps an adult, the type of relationship that you had. So whether you're a spouse or a friend, the nature of the relationship that you had as well, whether it was close or, you know, remote or difficult or troubled, and the way the person died. So, for instance, after a long illness or sudden death or suicide, as you've raised. And there's also, you know, many other factors that can influence that as well. I think suicide is just such a complex area. And one of the good things is that we are learning more about it. So even at a local level in Gippsland, the Gippsland Primary Health Network ran some place-based suicide prevention trials, and they've developed some really great resources around how the community can create a suicide safety net, how perhaps organisations can as well. And so they're downloadable from the website. Anybody can access them. Sporting clubs, you know, different types of community. Another thing people can do is also skill themselves up so they can access training like mental health first aid or assist training, just to give them a little bit more skill in that area as well, in terms of being able to identify what might be happening for a person and also being able to support them. Some of the other resources that were developed through the Gippsland Primary Health Network were some podcasts in relation to suicide. And one of the podcasts particularly was featured Sean Walsh and Louise Flynn from the Jesuit Social Services. So they run the Support After Suicide program, which provides counselling and group support to people who've lost someone to suicide. And in that, they talk about, you know, sometimes people having quite a deep sense of guilt or a sense of responsibility for what's happened. So there's lots of complexities around that. So I think the Jesuit Social Services, the Support After Suicide, is a really relevant and perhaps helpful, you know, resource for people that might have been bereaved to suicide. When it comes to how we talk about grief and death, when it comes to suicide, there are some particular things that we promote, ways that we promote responding, and also those that we would caution against. And again, there's some really great resources. So Roses in the Ocean created a language and imagery guide around suicide, and MindFrame also have some guidelines as well. So we can hopefully put all of these links on the website for your readers as well. Because we don't want to unintentionally glamorise suicide, for instance, right? So, and we also know that sometimes it can, you know, lead to other unintentional kind of consequences. So I think it is important, and I think those two guides, the language and imagery guide and also the MindFrame guidelines, certainly would be my kind of go-to places if I was thinking about how to communicate in a responsible way around death by suicide. When it comes to how we talk about death generally, I think, again, it depends on the age of the person that we might be talking to And there's, again, some great websites on how we can have age-appropriate conversations with loved ones around death as well. And there's also a growing call within the literature, within the grief literature, to talk about death openly. So Paul Wong, who's a researcher, talks about encouraging talking about death in a way that's liberating, humanising and life-enhancing, and that we should also think about how we can develop grief literacy, and that's really the capacity to access and use knowledge regarding the experience of loss, to be compassionate and supportive and caring towards people who are bereaved, because we know sometimes when we experience grief, that can sometimes feel quite isolating. And sometimes people can withdraw from us simply because they don't know what to say. So, you know, so I think helping people to enhance their grief literacy is really important around, you know, how to respectfully and appropriately support someone.
That's a really good point, because I know there's a, you know, socially there's a bit of contention around, especially where children are involved, you know, whether or not to have that conversation with children. You know, some people will say, no, you know, don't let the child even know that death might be occurring. If mum dies, don't let the child attend a funeral, so on and so forth. But you're right, the research is starting to show, and it's, you know, being talked about that having those conversations and discussing it allows the space to actually grieve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting because when I did a review of the literature a couple of years ago, even in relation to advanced care planning, so, you know, planning for end of life and for death, you know, significant numbers of people don't plan for their end of life because they find it too emotional or it's too distressing to think about death. They think that family members will just make the right decision on their behalf. You know, they've never thought about it. They're not sick enough. They haven't got around to it. Or the family just don't want to talk about it. And so I find that when I work with people around developing an end of life plan for them, so not an advanced care plan, but like a partner document to that, one of the barriers often is I don't want to upset my family. You know, they're not ready to talk about it. So there's this view that we have this sanitized kind of view of death now, and it's very, you know, medicalized. And I think, you know, this is another area where people like death doulas can perhaps play a role in terms of supporting families at the end of a person's life, and also supporting the people who are bereaved, you know, after the person has died as well.
50 years ago, we you know, we attended church so much more often. We were so much more community-based, whereas we don't have that community around us, which can make grieving so much harder.
Yeah, absolutely. Increasing numbers of people are feeling isolated within the community. There are members of the community who, you know, don't have the grief literacy or the words to communicate about death, which, you know, kind of further increases a sense of isolation as well. And look, I remember when I was a kid growing up in Traralgon, sometimes you would see typically kind of what I thought was older women back then, but they're probably younger than I am now. But they would be dressed all in black, right? So because I think it was a Catholic custom or tradition that, you know, for the first X amount of time after a death, you would wear black. So it was much more visible, you know, the customs and the rituals and the traditions, whereas I don't see that so much anymore. You know, we don't have, death doesn't seem to have the same sense of visibility. I'm not sure that's even a real statement, but yeah, that would be my sense.
But it's a good point, which kind of, I guess, leads into my next question around managing our expectations of grief.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think you know, there's no right way to grieve, and we're all on a different timeline. So I think it's very individual, and, you know, the as we go through life, we're likely to experience grief, you know, a number of times or in a number of situations or circumstances. And each time we experience grief, it could be quite different. So I think really for me, it comes down to self-compassion. I think that, you know, there's more and more research coming out in relation to self-compassion and how that can be helpful in terms of decreasing suffering. And mm-hmm. I think grief is one form of suffering. So, you know, self-compassion, it's more than self-care. It's quite different to self-care. That's around being kind to yourself, as opposed to, you know, judgmental. It's about having a sense of common humanity. And I find that really important, because when things go pear-shaped for me, I often think, well, I cannot be the only person that's experienced this, right? Mm-hmm. So there's been people that have come before me. How did they cope with it? How did they manage? What did they do? Because sometimes, again, it can be quite isolating. So how do we reach out to others for support, I think, is important. Mm-hmm. And have that sense that, you know, this is part of being human. And the third element of self-compassion, and this is all Dr. Kristen Neff's work. So the third mm-hmm. element of self-compassion is mindfulness. So mm-hmm. how do we kind of, you know, be mindful of our thoughts, feelings and behaviour, and not just get hooked into that, you know, spiral of negativity or self-blame and shame that can sometimes happen. So how do we kind of have that sense of perspective around our thoughts as well?
I think that we need to remember throughout the entirety of our life's journey to be, regardless of what kind of grief it is, to be compassionate and to be mindful and to give ourselves some grace. Allow ourselves just to feel what we need to feel and respect that it's okay to feel that at that point in time, that there's a reason for it, and we need to just respect our process to process it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that's so important in terms of ambiguous loss, and also knowing that, you know, some days will be better than others, mm-hmm. some weeks or months will be better than others, and, mm-hmm. you know, and that we can, you know, laugh and be grateful for what we have, and also have moments of despair. And mm-hmm. they coexist. It's not an either or. I think it's a both and, you know, mm-hmm. both these things can and do happen and coexist. Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific time to be mindful of that if we observe within ourselves where it's like, okay, now is the time to reach out and ask for support from somewhere?
Yeah, I think anyone who's grieving can benefit from human connection, right? And certainly with ambiguous loss, that's one thing that Dr. Pauline Boss says, is that we just need, not that we just, there's other things as well, but that human connection is really important. And I think that if you are noticing, so I think, you know, allowing yourself to grieve, as you said, creating positive memories, seeking support, I think mm-hmm. is very important at each stage of grieving. And if you're starting to notice that you have really persistent feelings of sadness and despair, or if you're unable to experience happiness, then, you know, if your feelings are getting in the way of your everyday life, then, you know, perhaps it might be important to reach out to professional supports mm-hmm. as well as informal supports, and especially, you know, seek help if you're feeling like your grief is making it difficult for you to do anything, and that might include, you know, socialising or sleeping, mm-hmm. you know, if it's impacting your the way you eat, or mm-hmm. you're experiencing intense or ongoing emotions, mm-hmm. Then I think, you know, consider reaching out for professional help as well. Mm-hmm. And the good thing is that there's lots of supports that are available. You know, mm-hmm. there's the Grief Line that has a 1-300 number. There's Grief Australia. My Grief Assist, Compassionate Friends, Care Connect. The list goes on, and I'm sure you will list them on your website as well. Yeah.
I will, definitely. Is there a knack tool, I suppose, to finding, not necessarily a grief counsellor, but the right, I guess, counsellor for you if you want to see someone face-to-face?
Yeah, look, I would definitely say do your research, or that would be the approach I would take. And think about how you can start to perhaps develop a relationship with the person. So for me, there's one grief counselling service that I've attended a number of webinars, you know, that they've had just to get a sense of, you know, their personality and their perspective on death, to see whether that resonates with me, because I think it's such a personal thing. So, and I think it's really important that you feel comfortable with the counsellor and that you're able to develop rapport. So, so I would research them to start off with, get a sense of, you know, do they have the appropriate qualifications, for instance? What's their life experience been? And, you know, I think the thing is that you can always go for one session, and if it just doesn't feel right, then, you know, you can go and see someone else.
And lastly, are there any self-care tips, I suppose, that you would recommend for managing grief?
Yeah, so I think this, you know, comes down to the individual. So Dr. Lucy Hone has written a book called Resilient Grieving. And so she studied positive psychology, and her daughter, Abby, was killed tragically in a car accident a number of years ago now. So she's actually developed, she's written this book that has some really great practical strategies around grieving, which includes some self-care strategies as well. I think it's also doing things that you like, you know, take a bath, watch a funny movie, look after yourself. One of the things that I find helpful is walking. So I run some walking groups, and we're actually looking at setting up a grief walk as well for people, because there is some research that indicates, you know, both the social aspect as well as the walking aspect, you know, can be helpful for people in terms of helping to process grief as well. So I think I would just encourage people to do the things that they enjoy, and, you know, not to feel guilty about that. You know, it is okay to laugh and to, you know, feel joy and positive emotions, even though, you know, life has changed. So, and I think it also comes back to how we use our strengths as well, you know, doing those things that we're good at and that really energise us, that are life-affirming for us.
Well, I think that's a beautiful ending to today's podcast. Thank you very much, Linda. I genuinely appreciate it. It has been wonderful to speak to you.
Thanks so much, Bec.
Thank you. That was Linda Rowley on Theories of Hope.